Thank you so much, Ben. And for all of you who have come tonight, thank you. I'm going to try to get you out of here tonight by 8:30. But to do so, we're going to have to clip along at a pretty fast pace. Now, you've got how many handouts tonight? Two. So we're going to try to cover twice the amount of material tonight in half the amount of space. If you don't have two, raise your hand raise a finger, whichever one you need, number one or number two. Number one is the one that says the way of peace. Number two is the one that should say page three or page four. Should be kind of self-explanatory. John 3:17 is not the first verse in your handout, but it's the verse we want to start off with. It's the theme of this week. God did not send His Son into the world to condemn the world, Jesus told Nicodemus, but that the world through Him might be saved. And the Greek word there for saved is actually healed. Do you remember when Zacchaeus was changed? And Jesus said, today salvation has come to this home. Salvation for us isn't just being released from a penalty and there being no change in us. Humanity's problem isn't a penalty that's hanging over their head. Humanity's problem is that we're sick and we need, what's the opposite of sickness? We need healing. And that's what we see in the Jesus story. Jesus went around, true or false, we covered this last night, whether it's true or not, what we see in the Jesus story is that Jesus went around as the Savior of the world, and what did He do? What did He go around doing? Healing people. Wherever He found sickness, He brought them into harmony. God is setting the world right within the Jesus story. Jesus says, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. He says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice, for they will be filled. That you hunger for the world to be put right. He has all these, the Lord's Prayer, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Today, Christianity is tempted to misguide, to misfocus us on either getting to some far distant heaven or just having some personal, privatized relationship with God. And I think either one of those, if it leaves the world unaffected, is dangerous. I don't want to be misunderstood, as the great scholar N.T. Wright writes, heaven's important. How many would agree with that? But it's not the end of the world. And does God want to have a relationship with you? Yes, but He wants to put you right, so that from that rightness, you can join the human family and be a conduit through which He's also putting the world to right as well. So any type of diversion from God's work in putting the world to right, any type of diversion, whether it be some far distant heaven that doesn't care about what's going on in the world, or just some privatized, internal, personal relationship that doesn't care about what's going on in the world, both of those are imbalances. How many can see that this evening? Whatever it is, God wants us to be part, according to the Jesus story, the God in the Jesus story wants us to be part of a work of healing. The very first thing the disciples were to do when they were going forth proclaiming the gospel is He said, and heal the sick. How many believe we live in a sick world? And we're going to talk about that this weekend as well, and what God calls us to do. Tonight we are talking about one of the most significant ways that Jesus gave us to heal the world. Last night we looked at probably the most significant, which was Jesus' teachings on radical, what was the word we used? Inclusivity. To no longer see us and them. It's just a we. We're all children of the same divine parents. Are you with me? And He's trying to reconcile us all, not just to Him, but to each other. That's healing the world. If you can see that, say yes. But tonight we're going to look at a method, an ethic that He gave us, because we're looking at the ethical teachings of Jesus. If you weren't here last night, go back and listen to that presentation so you can get up to speed. But we're looking at the ethical teachings of Jesus. And the second one we're going to look at is a direct way that Jesus gave us to effect change in society around us. Matthew 5:38-44. Jesus says, you've heard that it was said, what? Talk to me, because I got to get you out of here at 8:30. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That's the path that everyone's on, am I right? That's how everybody lives. You hit me, what do I do? You call me a name, what do I do? It's eye for eye, tooth for tooth, tit for tat, quid pro quo. You do something to me, I do the same. We call that retaliation. Retaliating is returning like for like. What is retaliation defined as? Returning like for like. Now he says, where had they heard it from? Who taught eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth? Moses. This is actually in the Bible. So some could actually be biblical and go against Jesus. How many can see that in this passage? It's not enough to be biblical. I've met lots of people that were biblical, but they weren't like Jesus. So why? But let's talk about it for just a second. Why would he contrast what he's saying with what Moses taught? Well, there's a 9 in there too somewhere. When God got a hold of the Hebrew people, and he was, according to the Hebrew narrative, they have the story that they were slaves in Egypt. And I know some people debate that, but that's their narrative. That's their story. They were slaves in Egypt. And when he brought them out, they were a train wreck. They were slaves for 400 years, according to the story. They didn't have the ability to self-govern. Can God just come in and meet them on first time meeting and get them from number 1 all the way to number 10 upon first encounter? How many are thankful that God doesn't expect you to be where he's at the first time he meets you? How many are thankful that God meets you where you're at and patiently grows you into what he wants you to be in a long, slow, healthy process? How many are thankful for that this evening? This is what we see happening with the children of Israel. God meets them in number 1. And number 1, where they're at is, listen, you hit me, I'm not going to hit you back. You hit eye for an eye? No. You take out my eye, I'm going to chop off your head. You're going to chop off my head? Fine. I'll wipe out your whole family. Oh, you're going to wipe out my whole family? Fine. I'll wipe out your whole tribe. Oh, you're going to wipe out my whole tribe? I'm going to wipe out your whole nation. Do you see how violence escalates in that scenario? How many would think it would be a good place to start with a group of people that are addicted to violence to at least get them to tone it down to where it's at least equal? How many would agree that that's probably a good first step? But is that the ideal that God wants? How many would agree that's it's moving in the direction of what God wants? It's part of the same moral trajectory, but it's an accommodation. It's a concession. So God says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But where is that along the progression? Which number? Number two, what God commands through Moses and many times is not his ideal. It is what he's trying to, where he's trying to meet. Number two also includes slavery. How many would agree that's not God's ideal? Number two also treats women as a little bit more than property. How many realize that's not God's ideal? Please raise your hand on that. Yes. Thank you. And it also involves not just slavery and treat, it also involves polygamy. How many would agree that's probably not God's ideal? By the way, it's actually an act of injustice because men could have more than one wife, but wives could never have more than one husband. It didn't go the other way, which is kind of weird. But that's actually, even if they were allowed, I don't think women would have done that because they're smarter than men. But anyway, one husband's enough for many wives. Regardless, you had slavery, you had polygamy, you had what Jesus is going to show us tonight, and we're going to have to wrestle with this. Is there violence in the Old Testament? Yes. What we're going to have to wrestle with is the violence that we find endorsed by Moses and others in the Old Testament. Does that fall into the same category as the polygamy and the slavery that were also endorsed and worked through? Or is violence God's ideal? What did Jesus teach? And from the very beginning, can you find violence in the Scriptures? Yes. Can you find sacred violence in the Scriptures? God looks like Jesus. We did not always know this, but now we do. He says, I know you've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. What's the next word? But. What does but mean? Yeah, hang on a minute. That's a great definition of but. I tell you, but I, to the contrary, do not, what's the word there? Retaliate against an evil person. Now, I don't know if we have time for this, but let me throw this out there. In most translations, like the King James that you'll read, they use the word resist. Don't resist an evil person. Is there a difference between not resisting an evil person and not retaliating against an evil person? Is there a difference between the two? Yes. Why would the King James be translated into resistance? And most translations have never corrected the translation here. Most translations will say that Jesus taught, do not resist an evil person. Did Jesus spend his life resisting evil? Yes. So why would Jesus? Well, because when King James of Scotland commissioned the translation of the Bible, it was very important that there be a version of the Bible that did not challenge empire. Are you with me? Would it have been important in 1611 for the King of Scotland to believe, for Jesus' followers to believe that their Jesus, when they see an evil person, not to resist them? Would he have had some, what do they call that? Conflict of interest in that passage, translating it that way. The Greek word here is anthistomai. Anthistomai comes from two Greek words, anti and histomai. Histomai is the verb form of the noun stasis, and it's in your gray section. If you're not into words, you don't need to know any of this. What I want you to know is the root of anthistomai is stasis. Stasis is a violent rebellion. It's an armed revolt. It's used in the Greek version of the Old Testament 71 times. 44 out of those 71 times is one military violent force coming against another. He just said, I know you've heard an eye for an eye. That's returning like for like. But, and then he says, but I tell you, do not anthistomai an evil person. Anthistomai is better translated as retaliate, not resist. And I'm going to prove it to you. What some people subscribe to is violence. How many have ever encountered someone who's addicted to violence before? They're just a very violent person. Some people believe that what Jesus taught was passive-ism. I'm spelling it that way on purpose. In other words, if someone strikes you on one cheek, what are you to do? Just turn the other. But I've heard so many interpret this as meaning you just roll over and become a doormat. How many have ever heard that interpretation or you've gotten that impression from this passage? It's passivism. Now, how many have ever been concerned by interpreting Matthew 5 in a way that makes people who are being abused doormats? How many have ever been concerned by that? What is Jesus really teaching? Jesus is teaching neither violence nor passivism. He's actually teaching something that has been labeled today as NVDA, or nonviolent direct action. And I'll show it to you in a moment. Bear with me. Or some have called it passivism. Now, I want you to see that phonetically, those sound a lot alike, do they not? But they are not the same thing. Pacifism is not passive. It's active. But what's the root word, the Latin root word of pacifism? Pac. It's peace. It's using peaceful methods to bring about world change rather than violent methods. What I want you to notice first is, even in the term, is it passive? Talk to me. Is it passive? No, it's just using different methods to create the outcome rather than violent ones. What you'll find is many times people will be arguing on two sides of an issue. Some will be arguing for violence, some will be arguing for being passive. And how many have noticed that in an argument, usually both sides are wrong, the solution's usually a third option? How many have seen that in life? Yes, this is what we have going on here. Let me illustrate it for you the way that Jesus did. Jesus says, if anyone slaps you on the which cheek? Talk to me now. Which cheek? The right cheek. The devil is in the details. Don't miss the details here. He doesn't say just the cheek. He says, if anyone strikes you on which cheek again? Now, how many have ever been to a third world country where they don't have indoor plumbing? How many have ever been to a situation like that before? Mission trip? Anything? Anything? Okay. Tell me what they do with their left hand. Don't be graphic. Yes. It's everything unclean. Are you with me? A matter of fact, in Jesus' culture, if you look down there, I'm going to read to you from the Dead Sea Scrolls, to even gesture at the Qumran with those that, within that community, to even wave, to gesture at someone with your left hand. This is not just touching people with your left hand. This is to even wave at someone with your left hand carried the penalty of exclusion and 10 days penance. You were excluded from the community for 10 days for just waving with the left hand. So everybody take your left hand, put it behind your back. If you can do it, put it behind your back. You're not allowed to use it. Okay? Now, I want you, where you're seated right now, I want you to imagine that you're going to strike me on my right cheek. That's this one, by the way. Yeah, keep trying. Nope, you just hit my left one. Hit my right cheek. Oh, yeah. Except for that's kind of unnatural. A more natural way would be, what do we call that kind of? It's a backhanded slap. Yes. I won't tell you what they call it. But yes, it's a backhanded slap. Are you with me? And this had a cultural significance in Jesus' day. If someone was your cultural equal, you would use your right hand and you would strike them with a closed fist and it would land on which cheek? Their left. But if you're going to strike their right cheek, that required this type of a strike, the backhanded slap. And that was used. It was a way to strike people that communicated to them that you are lesser than me. Get back in your place. Do you see it? It is how a man, thank God we live in the 21st century and not the first century, but it's how in the first century Palestine, a man would have struck a woman. He would have never struck a woman with a closed fist. It would have been a backhanded slap. Get back in your place. It's how a master would have struck a slave. It's how an adult would have struck a child. Jesus says if they strike you on the right cheek, if they give you a backhanded slap as if to put you back in your place, he said, then you stand there in your God-given dignity. And does he say strike back? Does he say hit them back? So is it the top option, the violent response? Does he say do nothing? No, he doesn't give you the bottom option either. He tells you to stand there in your God-given dignity and say, okay, that's fine if you want to hit me, but you hit me on the wrong cheek. Offer them the correct cheek to strike. Now, process this. Contemplate this with me. Is Jesus opening them up to the possibility of greater violence in that moment? No. Because for that person to strike them on that cheek, what has to happen inside of that person for them to strike them on the left cheek? No. You can't change hands. Not hands. That's not what has to change. You have to acknowledge that that child, that woman, that slave is your equal. And would they have been willing to do that? No. Are you with me? So he's not opening them up to greater violence, but what is he doing? He's giving us a non-violent direct action that has the endeavor of trying to wake them up to the systematic injustice, the dehumanization, the objectification that they are themselves a victim to. Are you with me so far? Let me give you another one. He says, if they try to steal your, anyone wants to sue you and take away your shirt, hand over your coat as well. This is a horrible translation. It's the only English one we have, but it's a shirt and coat are, it wasn't the same. They didn't wear the same thing back then. How many realize that? Their clothing didn't, they didn't wear shirts and coats back then. What they wore was a chiton and a hemation. The chiton very quickly was the under clothing. Not underwear, not Fruit of the Looms. It was the garment they wore closest to their skin. You've seen pictures of it in maybe some Greek pictures or Greek films, or it's kind of a mini skirt, the one piece that men even run around in. You know what I'm talking about? Short sleeves, skirts cut off right here. Men wore them, women wore them. If you know what I'm talking about, say yes. Okay, and then that was the chiton. The hemation, if you think of the traditional icon of Jesus, how he's got that sash thrown over his shoulder, the hemation was the sash. Now, men could wear the chiton by itself or the hemation by it. They could wear the hemation bare-chested. They just draped over them as long as the other parts were covered. And both were considered acceptable. Women could wear the chiton by itself, or they could wear the chiton with a hemation, but they could not wear a hemation by itself. And I don't need to draw you a picture. You get it. But men could wear either one. Now, in this culture, there's something else you have to realize. That if you were being sued for an article of clothing, this would have only happened to one people group. You see, if you were so poor that you didn't have property to use as security for a loan to a wealthy individual, the law allowed you to use one of your last two articles of clothing. How many articles of clothing do you have in your name? Two. You could use one of them. And I've given you the passages. You can look at them when you get home in Exodus and Deuteronomy. At night, the article had to be returned back to the poor person so they could stay warm. And the next morning, the creditor had to stand outside and wait for the poor person to bring them the article. They couldn't go in and just get it. But there was this legal system set up. What's gone wrong if someone is being sued for one of their last two articles of clothing? What's gone wrong? They've defaulted on their loan. Now let's think about it. Are they in need? Yeah, the guy that's loaned them, does he have more than he needs? What's the definition of greed, by the way? The definition of greed is hoarding more than I need for today out of fear of what might happen to me tomorrow, while people around me today don't even have their common needs being met. You have a wealthy person because all he wants is more. Are you with me? It's just fair. It's fair. Fair. They sign the papers. It's fair. It's legal. How many realize that if you want a world that's fair, you're going to be sorely disappointed with the world that Jesus is creating? And we'll talk about this on tomorrow night. But according to the Jesus story, Jesus isn't about establishing a world based on fairness. He's establishing a world based on need, what people's need is. And how many are thankful that we don't always get what we deserve? How many are thankful for that? It's what we need that we get. But nonetheless, you've got a wealthy, greedy person suing an impoverished person. Now let's add some more puzzle pieces to it. In this culture, both men and women wore dresses. I don't care what you call them. That's what we call them today. And ladies, when you wear a dress, you have to act a little differently than where you're wearing pants. Am I correct? I don't know this for myself. I just have a wife and two daughters. And that's what they've told me. So when you wear, because the potential for immodesty being exposed is greater in a dress than in pants. If you agree with that, say yes. And so in this culture where both men and women wore dresses, so to speak, or skirts, I don't care what you call them, the potential for immodesty to be exposed was of a heightened nature than what we experience today. Therefore, when anyone's nakedness was exposed, it was never the shame of the person who was accidentally exposed. The shame would always fall on the person who, guess what, looked at it. In other words, if someone was, then the respectful thing to be would be what? To turn away, to avert your gaze, give them some privacy, give them some respect. If you looked at it, then the shame was on you. How many remember the story of Noah's son, how he looked on his father's nakedness and the two brothers came in backwards to cover him up so as to not look on their father's nakedness? Remember, this was the culture Jesus was in. What is Jesus saying? And I love this. This is fascinating. If they're suing you for one of your articles of clothing, then you stand there in that courtroom and you do what? Please don't do it here. This is before the invention of the fruit of the looms. before the invention of, do you guys have Hanes down here? What do you call your underwear down here? Undies. Yes. Okay, good. This is before the invention of undies. We've never used that term here or anywhere, really. Undies. Great. I love it. So if you were going to say, hey, fine, you want this, then have this too. Give both articles of clothing. That would lead you standing in the middle of that courtroom in what state? Stark naked, as if to say to this whole tribunal, shame on you. Do you see it? Now, is it violent retaliation? Is it passive? No. But is it a nonviolent direct action seeking to wake them up to the systemic injustice and their dehumanization of human beings? See, it's what Martin Luther King called the double victory, where he said, do what you will to us and we will still love you. But know this, that we will match your capacity to inflict suffering with our capacity to endure such suffering. And in the end, he said, we will win the double victory because we will not only win our freedom, we will win you with it. The goal of what Jesus is teaching here, whenever we encounter violence, is not to retaliate with just more violence. What does that do? He's giving us nonviolent ways to wake people up to the systemic violence that they themselves are a victim of, and to win them away from it to following Jesus too. How many are beginning to see something in this story that you haven't seen before? What you do, and I know we want a domesticated Jesus. I know we want a conventional Jesus. I know we want a housebroken Jesus. But whether we like it or not, Jesus is actually here endorsing public nudity as a form of nonviolent protest. Sorry. How many are realizing Jesus might be a little bit more radical than what our little cradle roll classes have sometimes? Yes. Yes. Last example. They force you to go 1 mile, go 2. Centurions could coerce, by law, they could require you, conscript you, to carry their burden, their load 1 mile. But there was, it was limited, okay? If the centurion forced you to go more than one, they would be penalized by their superiors. There was a consequence. Jesus is saying, when you get to the end of that 1 mile, what do you do with the burden? Don't give it back. Keep carrying it. You got to imagine that Roman soldier now saying, no, you got to give me back that burden or else I could be in trouble. And then you got to imagine that Jew. Remember, Jews hated the Romans. If anybody wanted anybody to experience vengeance, it was the Jews wanting the Romans to experience vengeance from God one day. And Jesus is telling them, learn how to go the second mile for a Roman. You got to say, no, I'll volunteer. If you get caught, I've got your back. I'll cover for you. I'll tell your superior this was of my own volition. It's my gift. And then you got to wonder, what kind of conversation went down that second mile between that Roman soldier and that Jew when that soldier knew that Jews hated him? How many can see that Jesus is giving us a way to change the world? Can you see it? Wow. Is he making us doormats? No. He's giving us a way to change the world. He says, and I have heard, you've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Oh, how many realized last night there is no more enemy? How many realize, really what God's wanting to teach us is how to forgive. Right, did you get that? How to love those that have wronged us? He says, hate your enemy, but I tell you what? What's it say? We're not going to get out of here in 10 minutes. I tell you to love your enemies. All of this, it's not just inflicting them with shame for shame's sake. Are you with me? It's not using shame as a weapon. It's because you actually genuinely love them. It's rooted and grounded in love. Gandhi wanted Britain to leave. But when she left, Gandhi wanted them to remain. He wanted them to leave as friends. He didn't want to just defeat Britain. He wanted to win Britain to seeing that it was better for them to go. Are you with me? Do you see the difference? John 18:36. We got to move quick. Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to what? Prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. Was Jesus fighting in this moment? Think of what's on the screen. Was Jesus fighting? Yes. But was he doing it the top way? No. Was he doing it the middle way? The third option? Yes. See, he said, they would fight to prevent my arrest. Was Jesus fighting? Absolutely. But we fight the world's injustice not with a sword, but with a cross. Isn't that what Jesus demonstrated? He says in Luke 9, 20 through 24, what about you? He asked, who do you say that I am? Peter answered, God's Messiah. Jesus strictly warned them not to tell this to anyone. And he said, the Son of Man must suffer what? Many things and be what? Rejected by the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and whether you believe it or not, it's part of the story. Once again, what's the story truth? He must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Then he said to them all, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their what? The cross would have been never what the early followers of Jesus said that Jesus did instead of them. They would have said, yes, Jesus died for me, but they would have never said Jesus died instead of me. The cross was that which they believed they were to take up to and join Jesus in as the way. Isn't the cross this in cosmic measure? Where he's not retaliating, are you with me, with violence, nor is he being passive. What is he doing? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they... And even though the Pharisees missed it, in the Gospel of John, John has a centurion looking up at this dead Jew hanging on a cross, saying, surely this man was innocent. Do you see it? Did it work for that centurion that day? Was he woke? Did something awaken inside of him? Now, it might have not gone to full fruition, but you can see how it works. Look at it in Luke 22, 49 through 53. Jesus' followers saw what was about to happen. And notice their motive is good. They're just trying to defend someone that they think is defenseless. He says, Lord, should we strike with our swords? And one of them doesn't wait for the answer. John tells us it was Peter. Because one of them struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear. This is the greatest tragedy of the entire Jesus story, by the way. This is the moment where all of us should say, I've been robbed. Why? Because Peter was not Zorro. Do you know who Zorro is? He didn't just go, that's a warning. Next time out. No, that's not how Peter was aiming at the guy's head, and the guy just happened to duck, and it glanced off his head and took off his ear. I feel robbed. That would have been the coolest miracle of the entire Jesus story. That would have been awesome. Instead, we're stuck with an ear. I didn't write this story. But notice, he struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear, and Jesus answered, what does he say? No more of this. And he touched the man's ear and healed him. Then Jesus said to the chief priests, the officers, the temple guard, the elders who had come for him, am I leading a rebellion that you come at me with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts, and you did not lay a hand on me, but this is your hour when darkness reigns. Look at Matthew 26, 52. This is what Matthew has Jesus saying in this discourse. Put your sword back in its place, Jesus said to him, being Peter. For all who draw the sword will what? Those who live by the sword will what? We are slow to learn that lesson, aren't we? I know the Sermon on the Mount makes for lousy foreign policy, but nations that live by the sword, and I know who I'm referring to when I say this, are setting themselves up to also die by the sword, are they not? But we don't need to look just nationally or globally. Even in our own personal lives every day, aren't we met with the choice when we relate to others who have wronged us to live by the sword as well? Jesus is asking us to live by a different power. Luke 22, 35 through 36. People will raise this objection, and I want to look at a few objections before we're done. It says, when I sent you without a purse or a bag or a sandals, did you lack anything? Nothing, they answered. He said to them, but now if you have a purse, take it, and also a bag. And if you don't have a sword, then sell your cloak and what? I'll have people, especially where I come from, say, see, Jesus said, go buy a sword. How many have heard this objection before? By the way, Gandhi said everybody knows that Jesus taught nonviolence except for the Christians. If I could just be transparent with you, when America goes to war, do you know who the loudest cheerleaders are in America? Do you know who they are? white American evangelical Christians. That's who it is. Males. That's who it is. See, and they'll say, see, Jesus said, go buy a sword. I'm not going to take you to any other passage in the Bible. All I'm going to ask you to do is keep reading. I'm not going to pull any wool over your eyes. We're not going to try to disprove. All I'm going to ask you to do is just keep reading. In verse 37, the very next verse, flip over your page. Jesus says, why go buy a sword? Because as it is written, he was numbered with the what? The word there used for transgressors in this culture meant political enemy. If they did not have swords on their person, would Rome have been convinced that Jesus was a threat? They would have said, this is a religious matter, you deal with it. No, he claimed to be king. They had swords when we found them. Would that have gotten Rome's attention and now Rome get involved? So that Jesus is numbered with the political enemies of Rome. Would that have taken, look at the narrative of the story. And notice what happens, keep reading. I tell you this must be fulfilled in me. Yes, what is written about me is reaching its fulfillment. The disciples said, see, Lord, here are how many? How many? And Jesus says, that's what? How are two swords enough for 12 men if he expects them to use them? Number one. Matter of fact, we just read a few hours later, what does Peter do? Not just any sword. Peter actually pulls out one of these two swords. It's one of these two that Peter uses. He pulls out one of the two and uses it. And what does Jesus do? He says, put it away. That's not what I meant. Tertullian said, when Christ, early church father, when Christ disarmed Peter, he disarmed every soldier. That's heavy. Look at it in Matthew 10:34. Some will say, use this verse. Do not suppose that I've come to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a what? I'll have people say, see, he came to bring a sword. We're just being the sword of God, they'll say. Again, we're not going anywhere else. Just keep reading. Look at verse 35. The very next verse. For I have come to turn a man against his who? Daughter against her. A daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Your enemies will be members of your own household. Anyone who loves their father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. And anyone who loves a son or a daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take up their, what's the word? Cross and follow me is not what? Worthy of me. When Jesus said, I came not to bring peace, but a sword. Here's the question. Is the sword in the hand of the Jesus follower in these passages? Or is it in the hand of the one who is turning against the Jesus follower in this passage? Who's holding the sword here? Because Jesus turns and says, if you want to be my follower, when they come at you with a sword, you've got to be willing to take up and embrace the what did he call it? The cross. Do you see it? Did Jesus come to bring a sword? Yes, but not in your hand. He came to kick the sleeping dog, so to speak. What does that mean? When Jesus, do we have time to go into this? We'll get there in a moment, but when Jesus cleansed the temple, he was provoking systemic injustice. It was the temple police that came and arrested him. What did they do to him? They gave him a trial. He said he'd do away with the temple. And then they crucified him. How did Jesus respond to their violence? Violently or non-violently? Non-violently. And we're going to unpack this more Thursday night. But what did Gandhi see in this story? He saw that Jesus first provoked the unjust system by cleansing the temple. So what does Gandhi do in South Africa? Do you remember the story? Do you know the story, Gandhi's story? Gandhi first provokes the unjust system by tearing up his passport in South Africa. How did the South African government respond to him? Violently or non-violently? Violently. How did Gandhi respond? Non-violently. And did it create change? Yes. Gandhi actually said he got it from the Jesus story. When it came to India, what did Gandhi do? How many remember the great salt marches? Anybody know what I'm talking about with that? Yeah. What is that? That's provoking the unjust system, isn't it? It's the cleansing of the temple, so to speak. How did the government respond? Violently or non-violently? Violently. And how did he respond in return? Non-violently. The Baptist minister from the South, the great Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., would come and learn from Gandhi, Gandhi's understanding of the Sermon on the Mount, and he would learn to cleanse the temple, so to speak, in his own. Now, cleansing of the temple is about a lot more than that. I get that. We're not flattening it. We're just distracting from it. We're going to talk about it in greater detail Thursday night. But even King got from this, we've got to somehow provoke the system. And so what did King do in the South? How many ever heard, how many know that history back in the States? King would, orchestrate sit-ins. Do you know what sit-ins were? Establishments that said whites only. They would go in and they would just sit there. What would that do? Is that kicking the sleeping dog? Is that provoking the system? How did they respond? Violently. And then how did King's followers respond in response? Nonviolent, with nonviolent direct action. And did it create change? Yes. I have got some friends in Perth, Australia right now that are engaging in nonviolent direct action against Australia's immigration policy with the children that are being kept in retention. How many know what's going on over in Australia? I know you're not Australia, but you're closer than I am. But rabbis, priests, pastors, preachers, all these Christians are engaging in nonviolent, and they're getting arrested over this, although it's nonviolent. And actually, the government in Australia is now realizing there's got to be a change. Isn't that interesting? And where do all these people claim to have gotten this from? See, it's so easy to think that Jesus is just about getting us to heaven or just about giving you a personal, private relationship. Are you with me? How many would be willing with me, this is for me too, to admit that we've too often been too content with just getting to heaven or having a private relationship? We've not really paid attention to where Jesus calls us to be a conduit of change in the world as well. How many would be willing to confess that with me tonight? That's my story. That's my story. Luke 14:23. We don't have time to go through it. Augustine said, Jesus says, compel. Augustine said, doesn't tell you how to compel people to follow Jesus. He said, it's okay to run your enemy through with the spear as long as you love them in your heart while you do it. We'll talk about that in a second. Romans 13:4, someone will raise this objection, for in one, the one in authority is God's servant for you. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. See, those who bear the sword are God's servants. All I would like to remind you of in this moment, we're going to look at the context, but what I want to remind you of first is, where was Paul writing this from? A Roman jail cell. So we got to let that color these words. Look at Romans 12. This is the context. Don't repay anyone what? Evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. And if possible, as far as it depends upon you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take what? Revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's what? Wrath. Now let's follow it. For it is written, it is mine to avenge, I will repay, says the Lord. It's like my wife saying, if anyone needs punished, I'm going to do it, not you. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, you're to what? If he's thirsty, you're to what? What is he describing here? The top, bottom, or middle option? The middle. He says, in so doing, you'll be heaping coals, burning coals on their head. Do you see? Trying to wake them up to the systemic injustice that they are victims of. And he says, he says, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with what? With good. And I want to remind you, we don't practice nonviolence because it always works. Sometimes you lose. Sometimes you get strung up on a cross. Are you with me? But we don't let that deter us because we have the hope of a resurrection. You say, well, Herb, if it doesn't work, we may not always see it work in our lifetime. But eventually, it will work. But whether it works or not, we don't do this because it always works for us. It doesn't always end pretty. We do it because we're commanded to live this way by our Master Jesus Christ. And that's why a Jesus follower does this, whether it works or not. He says, and do not be overcome, but overcome evil with good. Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities. Thank you, Paul. I appreciate that as you write that from a Roman jail cell once again. The authorities that exist have been established by God, for rulers hold no terror. They are agents. They are God's servants. Agents of what? What I want you to notice, who's the agents of wrath in this passage? I got to get you out of here. Who's the agents of wrath? It's the state. Did he say leave room for God's wrath? Yes. Did he say you don't participate in God's wrath? You leave it up to God to do it through whatever means He sees, deems proper. Did he say that we're to participate in this? So even when he says the sword, those who bear the sword are God's servants, to a Jesus follower, you're not to participate in that. How many can at least see that from this passage? You're not to take it into your own hands. You're to leave it in the hands of those whom God has established. I'll give you a little bit of early church, and then I got to, we'll deal with that. 5 to 10 more minutes, and I'll get you out of here. My humble apologies. Kind of. It's worth it, isn't it? How many are learning something tonight? How many are glad you came this evening? Yeah, okay, good. Let's read the early church real quick. Go back over to page 2. Oh, we're still there. We haven't left it. Go to the gray section. This is the early church. For the first 300 years of Christianity, the early church fathers could disagree on anything and everything, and they did. If you go back and read them, they are all over the map on all different topics, except one. There's one topic where there is a unanimity among the voices of the early church for the first 300 years. We'll talk about what happens at 300 mark in a minute too. But for 300 years, they were unanimous. There was not one dissenting voice about this. And it was about nonviolence. To be a follower of Jesus in the early church for the first 300 years meant, I'm sorry, you weren't passive. You practiced nonviolent direct action. You were the proper definition of what a pacifist is. It says in, this is Origen of Alexandria against Celsus. I'm going to give you just a smithering of what the early church said about this. Origen says, "We no longer take up sword against nation, nor do we learn war anymore, having become children of what?" What does it say? Peace, for the sake of who? Jesus, who is our leader. Origen says again, "And to those who inquire of us whence we come," like, you guys are weird, where do you come from? He says, "For it is who is our founder?" We reply that we are come agreeably to the counsels of who? To cut down our hostile and insolent wordy swords into plowshares and to convert into pruning hooks spears that were formerly employed in war. Tertullian writes, "And shall the son of peace take part in the battle when it doesn't even become him to sue at law? Shall he apply the chain, the prison, the torture, the punishment, who is not the avenger even of his own wrongs?" Arnobius writes, "It makes no difference whether you put a man to death by word or rather by sword." He's talking about those who order soldiers to kill or that actually do it. He says it doesn't make a difference, since it is the act of putting to death itself which is prohibited. Therefore, with regard to this precept of God, there ought to be, what does he say? No exception at all, but that it is always unlawful to put a man to death whom God willed to be a sacrosanct creature. Here's the problem with using lethal force. Lethal force puts a period on the story right there. Jesus taught us to use a method that works to restore, redeem, and change even our enemies. And if we kill them, game over. We've just prevented them from even the hope of experiencing change. If you can see that, say yes. And Arnobius, it says, "Rather, it is better to suffer wrong." This is my favorite. "It's better, rather to suffer wrong than inflict it. We would rather shed our own blood than stain our hands and our conscience with that of another." Jesus followers will use rhetoric. They will use logic. They will use philosophy, they will use argument, they will use relationship, they will use love, they will use charity, they will use compassion, and if need be, they will use even their own death. But the kingdom of God is without coercion. We will not use violence in Jesus' name. And this is important because more blood has been shed in the name of the nonviolent Jesus than any other name in human history. We have taken a wrong turn. We have left the path of what it means to follow Jesus in this ethic. And we are so far off the path. And maybe not here in New Zealand, but think about Christianity back in the States. We are so far off the path. We don't even remember what the path looks like in some of this. The fact that you raised your hand, and I did too, so I'm not picking on you, but the fact that you raised your hand tonight and said you're learning something new would have been unheard of in the first 300 years of Christianity. This would have been what all Christians, the one thing all Christians agreed on. And yet today, it's something we discover after following Jesus for many years, or maybe some of you are discovering it tonight for the first time as you're considering following Jesus. If this is your starting point, man, you're so fortunate. Look at it, Hippolytus writes, anyone who has the power of the sword or who is a civil magistrate wearing the purple, he should desist or he should be what? You just can't bear the sword and follow Jesus too. There was no way around it. What happens in the 4th century, the 300s? What happened at that 300 mark? Well, for that culture, if you were a Christian, it simply meant you were a pacifist. And Christians were growing in number exponentially in the Roman Empire. If everybody's becoming Christian, i.e. pacifist, what does that mean for Rome? Listen, everybody can't be a conscientious objector in the war. Are you with me? Otherwise, there's no one to defend your borders. So Constantine saw it coming down the pike. He said, if everybody becomes Christian, Rome is going to fall to its enemies. And so, does anyone know the history of what happened? Constantine, through Augustine, this is Augustine's claim to fame, creates a theology that now places people like David and Joshua at the center of Christianity as the great heroes. The Old Testament accommodations of violence. And the peace teachings of Jesus become significantly marginalized. For the first time, Christians began picking up the sword and killing their enemies. This is why Christians started burning people at the stake. This was the root, the birth of that which would lead to the Crusades. This is where we see heretics, witches, Muslims, and Jews being burned on the stake, coerced into confessing Jesus. Scary what happened. Christians overnight go from a persecuted minority to a persecuting majority. What I would like you to do for a moment is imagine what would have happened if the church would have stayed true to Jesus' peace teachings. If they would not have abandoned the peace teachings but said, Constantine, you must become like us if you were to follow Jesus. We must not become like the empire for you to follow Jesus. What would have happened? Then eventually, what would have happened to Rome? Talk to me. It would have fallen by its enemies. A new empire, let's call it Empire B, would have taken over that territory. Would the Christians have still been present? Would they have still been growing exponentially? Then over time, what problem is Empire B now facing? It falls to its enemies. Empire C comes in, takes over that territory. Are the Christians still present? Are they still growing exponentially? Then eventually, what problems are Empire C now facing? The same. And at the end, we'll take questions in a moment. We're in a hurry. At the end, Empire D comes in. Are there still Christians present? Are they still growing exponentially? Yes. Then what problems is Empire D now facing? And eventually, what is the end result of that trajectory? Eventually, you run out of kingdoms of this world. And the kingdom of our Christ and of our King is the last kingdom standing. And he did it all through a cross and never lifted a sword once. Would many Christians have died along the way? Would they have given their life for this movement? But they died in the hope of a resurrection that one day this would work. And when it did, when Christ was restored as rightful king, then they would be resurrected into the earth made new. How many wish that's the way history would have played out? How many? Yeah. But Constantine converted. This is what Jesus is describing in Matthew 13, 31. He told them another parable. Page 3, top of page 3, and then we got to close. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a what? What's a mustard seed in that culture? It wasn't a plant. You did not plant this because you liked mustard. By the way, I know we're in a hurry, but I had, what did I have today? Tammy sauce? Tomato sauce? Tomato sauce? I hate ketchup. Your tomato sauce is so radically different. I think that's my favorite condiment now. That is amazing. I don't know why I just got off on that tangent. Oh, because you don't like mustard. Mustard in the early in this century was a garden weed. How many here garden? Anybody here garden? What do you do with weeds? You get them out. Why do you get them out? Because if you don't get them out, they'll take over the whole garden. Are you with me? He said the kingdom of God is like a weed in your garden. It's going to continually grow subversively until it crowds out all the other plants in the garden. Do you see what Constantine saw? Do you see it? He said it's like leaven that you put in bread. How does the leaven work? From the inside out, subtly, until the whole lump is a different substance. It's changed. This was the original plan. Now we're on plan B. Now we're on plan C. We might be even on plan Z. But how many can see what the original plan was tonight? This is what Jesus is calling us to, a way to change the world. The only objection that we get when we consider taking Jesus' peace teaching seriously, the real significant question is fear of foreign threat. Fear of foreign threat. It's what causes us to say, hold on a minute, Herb. I don't know if I'm ready to dive into that ethic. You thought last night's ethic was challenging. How many are realizing tonight goes a little even further? Because now you're not called to love your enemies just and include them. Now you're called to, if need be, let them kill you to try to wake them up to save them and win them to Jesus too. That's heavy. That's heavy. Fear of foreign threat. Think about Jesus with those who he spoke to. Did the Jews embrace him as their nonviolent Messiah? Or did they reject him? Why did they reject Jesus teaching love your enemies, those Romans? Forgive your enemies, those Romans. Seek to win your enemies to following me through this method, those Romans. Why did they? Because they were afraid. They said, if we follow this Jesus, it's going to let Rome just come in and march all over us. This is dangerous. Fear of foreign threat. If you can see it, say yes. In the 1600s, the Anabaptists in Europe, they're who the Amish and the Mennonites and the Hutterites come from in the States, and there's others in Europe. Anybody here happen to have some Anabaptist blood in you by the chance? Anybody? Anybody? Okay, I know it's New Zealand. I know it's a long shot, literally. The Anabaptists were the third Reformation in the 1600s. They discovered that what was marginalized it was not what Protestantism thought was marginalized in the baptism or the conversion of Constantine. What was marginalized, the Anabaptists believed, was the Sermon on the Mount. And so they began to live nonviolent lives. And do you know what the Protestants used as the argument against the Anabaptists? If we follow what these Anabaptists are teaching in nonviolence, it'll allow the Turks to overrun Europe. Do you see it? Fear of foreign threat. People will say, well, what about Hitler, Herb? Are you saying that Hitler should just be allowed to walk all over? Fear of foreign threat. Do you see it at first? But here, do you know what the most Christian nation was when Hitler rose to power? Do you know what the most saturated with Christianity nation was when Hitler came to power? Do you know what it was? It was Germany. the home of the Reformation. This is the home of Martin Luther himself. What would have happened if Christians would have stuck to the peace teachings of Jesus in Hitler's day? Hitler wouldn't have even been able to get an army. They would have all been conscientious objectors. Are you with me? You say, well, what about when that doesn't happen? Are we just to let it happen? I'll tell you the story of Metropolitan Kirill very quickly. Metropolitan Kirill was the Eastern Orthodox bishop of Bulgaria. Bulgaria is the one in Europe, correct? I always get that mixed up with Bolivia. That's not in Europe. Bulgaria, he was the Orthodox priest, the head of the Christian church in Bulgaria. Bulgaria struck a deal with Hitler. They had lost property, they lost territory in earlier wars, and Hitler said, if you turn over all your Jews, we will give back to you the property that we originally, you know, that you lost. And so they struck a deal with Hitler and said, fine, take them. So the train showed up at 11 o'clock that night, and the SS soldiers began herding up all of the Jewish citizens there in Bulgaria. Metropolitan Kirill got word of it. By the way, Eastern Orthodox or pacifists? Metropolitan Kirill got word of it, and he came running to the story says he's a 7'2" man. That's how tall he was. Can you imagine a 7-foot-tall man, Eastern Orthodox priest, wearing a black robe, long white beard, little black hat, running through the fog that night? Can you just imagine what that looked like stepping out of the fog that night? He shows up to this train station. The SS soldiers point their guns at him. And they said, I'm sorry, Father, you can't come in here. The story says he laughed at them. That takes guts. He laughed at them, pushed their guns aside, walked through the barbed wire enclosure, stepped onto one of the train cars that was packed with Jews on its way to Auschwitz. And they are it's just silent because they're praying for a miracle. What is the head of the Christian church going to say in this moment on this? And he reaches back into the Jewish narratives, into a story that would have been so meaningful to them. And he quotes from the book of Ruth, your people will be my people. Where thou goest, I will go, and your God will be my God. The train car erupts in applause. They wrestle Metropolitan Kirill off of the train car. He picks himself up, he sprints, 7'2", sprints towards the front of the train, throws himself over the tracks as if to say, I will not kill my enemies, but you're going to have to kill me if you're going to take them. That's the cross. Are you with me? It says they took them three hours to wrestle this 7'2" man off the train tracks that night. And the only way they were able to do it was finally, after those 3 hours, they let all the Jews off the train. And when the last Jew stepped off, Metropolitan Kirill picked himself up, dusted off his clothes, and stepped aside. And that train left that night with not one Jew on it. And it never came back again. And Bulgaria ended World War II being the only nation under Nazi rule to have more Jews within its borders than when the war started. And he did it. So don't be afraid. I'm not saying it always works. Are you with me? But don't let the fear of foreign threat. Terrorism today, I know. I get it. New Zealand, I get it that you're part of the West. But the East is not our enemy. They are brothers and sisters too. We're called to love our enemies. Are you with me? And someone say, okay, fine, forget global, Herb. What are you going to do when someone breaks into your home? You guys are allowed to own arms in New Zealand? Yes, some degree. It's regulated. It's probably more regulated than what we have. We have high school shootings every week. People say, Herb, what are you going to do when someone breaks in your home? Are you going to let them rape and pillage and hurt your family? What I want you to imagine tonight is, just imagine this for a moment. A burglar breaks into my home, hooded ski mask. He intends to do harm. He and I break into a tussle where we're fighting. And I'm trying to stop him, and I'm trying to reach my gun, and I'm trying to just stop this threat. And I grab his ski mask, and in the struggle, I pull off his ski mask. And what I discover is that it's my 17-year-old daughter strung out on heroin. In that moment, will I still stop her? Yes. Will I let her do harm? Will I turn passive? No. But will I still stop her? Yes. But will I kill her? No. Do you see? I'll stop her in a way that is neither the top or the bottom. It's in the middle. Are you with me? I will still stop her. But when she's not a stranger, all of a sudden it becomes different, doesn't it? Can we at least agree on that? It becomes a different scenario. And here's the kicker. Every intruder is the 17-year-old child of God. And we are called to realize we wrestle not against flesh and blood. If it's got flesh and blood, it's not your enemy, but against principalities and powers. And they are just the conduit of your real enemy. And you're called not just to save those who are about to be harmed, but as a Jesus follower, you're called to endeavor to save even the one through which the harm is going to come through. Do you see the difference? And I can't tell you how in every situation. Welcome to the beautiful challenge of what it means to endeavor to follow the ethical teachings of Jesus. But you know, if we just pull out a gun and blow them away, we'll never even ask these questions. Are you with me? How are we to do it? I don't have the answer for every scenario. But join the journey. How many can see that an eye, like Gandhi said, an eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind? How many can see that? How many can see that violence is escalating to such a degree that today, with today's technology, by the way, hats off to you for refusing nuclear whatever. How many can see, like what King said, that our choices today are not between violence and nonviolence. Our choices that lie before us today are nonviolence or annihilation. How many can see that on planet Earth today? How many can see that what Jesus taught, especially in the ethics of inclusivity last night and nonviolence tonight, that there's something in this that just might heal the world? How many can see that there's potential in it? Potential. I can't move that. It's taped. Sorry. Keep wanting to get it out of the way so I can end. I want to just talk to you with nothing in my way. I'm not saying it will always work. But God did not send His Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through Him might be healed. We're called to be conduits of healing. In the early church, the decision was not, do you want to accept Jesus as your Savior so you can go to heaven when you die? Nor was it, do you want to get to know Jesus better so you can have a private relationship with Him? I'm not denying heaven. I'm not denying the necessity of a relationship. All of that's important. But Rome saw the early church as a threat, and so it's the one that actually killed the apostles. Do you see it? Jesus calls us to have a relationship that reflects the kingdom of heaven in the here and in the now. Jesus calls us to be conduits of His grace towards our enemies in the here and in the now. And I know it's not easy, but there's a beauty in this journey. I've been asking you last night and tonight whether or not, as we look at the ethical teachings of Jesus, to ask yourself if there might be any, whether the story's true or not, if there's any cultural relevance to the ethics we find in the Jesus story. How many can see the cultural relevance in what we discussed this evening? How many can see that? Jesus is creating a new world. The question that was asked is, does the world that Jesus is trying to create, a new heaven and a new earth, a new world, does that look appealing to you? A world that embraces inclusivity and is nonviolent. At least those two ethics. If there was just a world where everybody was brother or sister, there's no more us and them. We're all we, and it was nonviolent. How many would want to be a part of a world like that? And this ethic may get you killed. But this is how we participate in making a world like that. How many would say, yeah, even if it cost me something, I want to learn how to live like this. How many would say, I want to learn how to practice this? That's what the question was. It wasn't, do you want to accept Jesus? It was, do you want to follow Him? He wasn't looking for people that were smart enough. I'm not going to ask for who's thankful for that. He wasn't looking for people who were sexy enough. He wasn't looking for people who were strong enough. Do you know what He was looking for? Just a few people that were crazy enough to go for this with Him. It was called the Jesus Revolution. Thank you so much for having me tonight. I'm going to hand it over to Ben. I went longer than I was supposed to. Forgive me. I'm only here for 1 week and I'm trying to pack it all in and then I got to go back home. But how many are thankful you came tonight? How many learned something this evening? Yes. And once again, last question. How many of you want to pursue this and learn how to put this into practice in a more applicable way? Yeah, we got to start with discovering the principle first, right? Now we need to learn how to apply that principle. It's a beautiful journey. I'm so glad you're here tonight. You guys are my heroes just for taking your time and being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.